All lines are now bridged.
All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. I think we're catching a little bit of echo here, but happy Tuesday. Hope everyone had a lovely Labor Day weekend. We'll get started with our ICAT Task Force roll call. We have Cheryl Turney, Alex Goss, Anil Jain, Gus Gerarcy, Jim Gergis, Ram Shram, Rich Landon, and Tom Mason. Are there any other members on the phone that I haven't announced? Okay, hearing none, I'll turn it over to our co-chairs to get us started.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Alex Goss. I'm going to kick us off today with a little bit of our summary and action plan. Michael Witte and I will walk you through the last few of the recommendations, wrapping up our work from the last meeting. Then we'll turn it over to Cheryl, who's going to launch us off with some discussion around the broader intersection of clinical and administrative data. A conversation that we've been eagerly wanting to get into. We'll then take some time for public comment before wrapping up with next steps today. Next slide, please. And one more. So this is a little bit of a background setup, a little recap from last weekend is also a setup for this week. Let me clarify that we focused the last call on the recommendations section of the draft report. This is a part of our ongoing effort over the last couple of meetings to ensure that we are appropriately capturing and editing revisions to the draft report write-up of the prior authorization work. This is a major section of the work that we've done over since March, and we're bringing that to sort of a solid state, enabling us to then pivot into the broader intersection conversation. So we did go back through a number of the comments we had received from members on the draft content for the data classes and guiding principles, ideal state, and then recommendations. And we have a bit of final tweaks that we, or I'm sorry, comments that we need to work through today. So without further ado, unless there are any questions, I'd like to go ahead and ask Michael Witte to cue up the actual report itself. I'm getting a lot of background noise, so if you could put yourself on mute, that would be fabulous. And I know Excel team will help us figure out maybe where that background noise is coming from. So the one of the things I wanted to highlight at this point was that the draft report that we're working on, I'm really putting report in air quotes because this report is only our work to date. It is not a complete master report yet. It will grow over the next couple of weeks and take shape into a formal looking report. I'm happy to announce that our amazing team at ONC has been able to secure us a writer, so we're going to be working on getting that person up to speed next week. That will help us with one voicing, so right now we're really focused on getting the right concepts and considerations into the narrative that's been captured so far. And to that end, we've been having members go through and review and comment on the content, then we're working through those comments. So we will continue the current round of commenting. We're picking up on recommendation 11, I believe. And this one is to establish standards for prior authorization workflows. And I'm going to try to make this screen better. So Cheryl, I'm not going to be able to see the Q&A at the moment, or if people are raising their hands. I would appreciate if you could keep us honest on making sure that as we work through this, we are able to get our members' questions addressed.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So recommendation 11, establish standards for prior authorization workflows. So we, in this case, we're talking about the the triggering and the workflows that needs to happen when we're really dealing with electronic health records and want to be API enabled. This is about driving efficiencies and reducing burden. We're really in that life cycle of standards to workflows and enabling us to really have highly computable data that lets us move forward. And so with reducing burden. So we did have some comments here. There was a comment from for Arian. So, Michael, you might need to keep me honest here. Is this a new comment we haven't processed yet? Because I know last time we were still catching up on a few things that had been addressed but maybe hadn't been resolved yet.
I believe it is because Arian added text subsequent to text in green that is substituted
yes.
to that comment.
Exactly. Alex, I was the one who brought this up on a prior meeting, and Arian went in and added the verbiage, the narrative, and I think this exactly speaks to what we were talking about.
Perfect. So what we want to do is acknowledge that that's been closed like I was doing last time since we had a slight disconnect on with vacations and editing, et cetera. So we can now that we know that Arian has come in and addressed a prior comment, we can consider that one closed unless there's any concerns from the audience, for the members.
We might just want to read out what came, Alex, since some of them can't read it because it's kind of small.
Okay, so I believe what we're looking for, and you have to understand also, I'm not driving, Michael's driving, so he has the ability to move the cursor. So I believe what we are addressing is that there were some green text that was embedded for this one that indicates that the task force recommends that the chosen standard or standards be sufficient to, one, determine which orderables, procedures, referral, or other activities are subject to prior auth, medical necessity, and other similar pre-approval checks. Two, determine the requirements and rules for approval of an orderable, procedure, referral, etc., sufficient to collect required documentation or justification. Three, automate the pre-approval workflow using the provider's chosen technology platform without relying on portals or payer-specific workflows. And the final point that was added was to determine the definitive status of a pre-approval request programmatically in the provider's chosen workflow.
Perfect.
Are there any? All right.
No one has their hands raised.
Thank you. We can go ahead and let's check that one as resolved so we can hide it, knowing that we don't lose that one. So, Michael, where are you taking me to next? He's just doing a little bit of cleanup from what
yep.
I can tell.
He's
accepting the text.
Keep us honest.
Okay. And appreciate everyone's patience while we do that, because this will help us not have carryover in future calls.
Bill, no hands up yet.
All right, thank you. So, Michael, where are you headed to next on the comment?
There's actually the second comment here on recommendation 11 about workflow in terms of real-time transactions, which may be covered by the automating in the provider's chosen technology, but there's discussion here, and we had discussed offline about the need for appropriate health IT to support reducing the need for prior authorization without, or at least having sufficient health IT in place that prior authorization isn't unnecessarily called for when the data exists and are easily or should be accessible in the
Yeah, Michael, I'm having a really hard time hearing you. You're really, really far away. I don't know if it's just me, but there seems to be a lot of background. Okay.
I'm afraid it's my
and he seems to be hearing us either.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think all of us are having a really hard time hearing you, which is making this a little bit more harder of an interaction. So,
okay, sorry, is that better at all?
Not really.
No.
I think what I'm trying to do is get my arms around.
I'm going to call in on a different number, so I will return. I will just leave the comment here so that you all can see it while I transfer my phone.
Okay.
So apologize for that little bit of a snafu, folks. I'm sorry, Cheryl, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I think the comment that Michael has here while he's trying to call back in really had to do with the real time where there was a question from a prior presentation from NCD or the folks that talked about Cover My Meds about real-time benefit checks. And I think that's what this really is, you know, trying to get to. But at the end of the day, I think what we said was we don't want to necessarily make real-time the goal. The goal is that the data for this one should be there when a provider needs to make a decision about a prior authorization. So from that perspective, data about the rules and all of the other things that we specified in here really need to be in a place within their system where they can access the information when they're trying to make a decision about the prior authorization, because a lot of it may not be specific for this particular patient until you say, yes, based on this clinical condition, you know, we think this patient should have this procedure. You know, then there is the ability to say, all right, now what are all the things that I need to do, and do I have all this data in front of me, or are there more tests I need to run, et cetera. So I think it was just trying to pull away from the fact that maybe with pharmacy it's easier to do a real-time benefit check because of what might be required, where if it's some other procedure or something of that nature may not be as necessary. And Jocelyn now does have her hand up.
Okay, so, and I've actually opened the document up so I can actually look at it myself, and that'll be helpful as we move forward. Jocelyn.
I'm back.
Wow, can we hear you? That's really great. Very much
better. Way better. Yeah.
So
now we have two hands up. So, Jocelyn.
I think that was Cheryl just calling on Jocelyn. So, why don't we go ahead and hear from Jocelyn if she can get her audio
great.
Through.
Thanks. So the only thing that I would maybe interject, and I love the sentiment of where it's going and that we can acknowledge that pharmacy is more mature at this point in time and moving towards real time than some of the clinical workflows are for medical prior authorization. But I would never want us to back away from the expectation that the data in the exchange should be real time or near real time. I think that from my experience, there are plenty of things that will hit the pause button on data being available or questions that need to be answered that will slow down anything happening in real time. But I think if we think about the service layer and we think about moving towards APIs, we want that ability for there to be inquiry response that is expected to perform from a technology perspective in real time. There may be data or gaps that require things to be queued and to be held until better information can be collected. But the access on either side, the expectation are at the service layer should be that things are real time. I don't know if folks are reading that differently than I am, but I would just never want us to back off of the expectation that in 2020 we should expect these interactions to be real time.
Yeah, I'm seeing Rich making a comment as well in the chat box, and it's reminding, I feel like we've, part of these notes from 818, we've already vetted and agreed to, and I feel like we're starting to have a repeat conversation here, and I think Rich is affirming that, as well as I think that's part of your commentary. So I think this may be one of those situations where we were, we're going to have a vehement agreement.
I agree, Alex. Yeah. Thanks.
So the next person's hand I see up, Cheryl, is Tom Mason.
Yes.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes, I was just going to say, I also agree with the real-time discussion that we're having, but I just wanted to point out something small. I think the recommendation looks good, but was just thinking about from a burden reduction perspective, if we may want to add a language related to a clinician and or a member of their care team in terms of being able to address within workflow, not focusing the language specifically on the clinician, but maybe add somewhere in there if they prefer to have a member of their care team a part of that workflow, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think what we could do is make a general comment to capture that for a future integration that we want to absorb that, Michael, or in review to incorporate an aspect related to the care team would be really nice, because the care team could be pretty diverse. So I think we want to make sure to figure out where we can weed that in appropriately.
This
Tom.
If I may, this is Michael. This reminds me of a conversation that we've had a little bit, I think, last week in terms of thinking about having the underlying health IT necessary to reduce the need for prior authorization where the information exists to obviate the need within the record, within the electronic record, which gets to an older concept of five rights for decision support, which is the right information to the right person at the right point in workflow, et cetera. So I don't know if folks would want to incorporate some of that into this language.
I think that's important. This is Cheryl. And the other thing I would say is the only hesitancy I would have about real-time or near real-time is the fact that I would hope our first goal would be not to have prior authorizations if certain situations are met, especially if it's a value-based care program. Then the easiest burden would be to not require a prior auth. So I don't want anything we say to preclude a payer's ability to go there and then feel like they have to have it because it's required in other cases where there is a prior auth and not and the provider might not be in a value-based program. So I just want to put those two comments out there as well. Like, you know, it should be the right information at the right time for the right action, but we shouldn't be requiring it if in this case, because of certain situations like value-based care, they're going to waive the prior authorization for certain set of procedures anyway.
So I think what we've had so far is this idea about making sure that we can involve the greater care team and that we're respecting the right person at the right time for the right reasons, the right data, the right clinicians, all that. So I think what I want to do is just capture that and move on so that we can address the last two recommendations, however, and move on to broader intersection conversation. But I do see Anil has raised his hand, so maybe you have a comment on recommendation 11, Anil?
Yeah, I just want to go back to some of the comments I've heard and go back to Michael's point. And we did discuss this at a prior meeting where we want to make sure that prior auth doesn't become a default because we didn't set up our existing decision support and alerts and guideline mechanisms into EHRs correctly. But once it does happen, I agree with all the comments about reducing the burden, involving the broader care team. And I think if we go back to last week or the week before, we'll have language in prior areas that alludes to the fact that we want to make sure that the electronic health record was set up with the appropriate decision support so that EPA becomes an exception rather than a broad rule that everything has to go through. Nothing anything different than what you guys are all saying, but I think we've discussed this a few times and there should be some comments in prior sections that we could refer to.
There's text in the guiding principles, and I actually drafted a while ago and can send to people if they want to look at some language to that effect that doesn't have a home.
Okay.
Well, if that text doesn't have a home, one of the things that we need to do is have Arian and Rich get us approval to take out all the all the text that's been struck through at the very bottom of this document in purple, that's a carryover from our earlier working documents. And I would like to have a section that would start to add in those other content that we like, but we're not sure where it goes. Because one of the things that I noticed this morning when I was working in this document for several hours was that we didn't have a table of contents and sort of a structure. So I added that at the beginning, little helpful hints, and then I've gone through and added a bunch of comments. And so I do think that this paper will morph notably as we start to add in the broader intersection conversation. So I don't want to try to find the right home now. I want to get the rest of the parts of the meal put out in the kitchen so we can plate ourselves the right dinner plate that we need to go into the dining room, so to speak. So Anil, I think your hand went down and then came back up, if I observed correctly.
Nope. I must have done something wrong. I don't remember touching it twice, but
I might have missed it. I didn't want to not call on you if you'd raised it again. So I think there's been a couple comments here in the chat box. So Jocelyn was talking about adding specifics to the right data, right time, and I noticed that Michael used the term the five R's. So I think we might need to make sure we're in agreement about what the five R's are that you're thinking of, Michael. Also, I didn't want to lose the point that Rich Landon indicated that he really felt that Cheryl's comment was fundamental, that if no prior authorization was necessary, that that's the most efficient workflow. So if there was some other comment we should be capturing there, Rich, to underscore Cheryl's remarks, please make sure we don't miss that. And Jocelyn, I see your hand is up. And you're on mute if you're speaking.
Thank you. I think that the only piece that I would add to that is that point that it being patient-specific information, because where things fall apart in current formulary and benefit is that it's not specific enough to be actionable. So everything, when we think about the right data at the right time, needs to be at the patient level. And being very clear about that, I think, gives you the grounding to make sure that you get data that's actionable in the moment, whether it's, do I really need to do a prior auth? Is it what's formulary or what's covered? Or do I need a referral? Getting that patient-specific validation, I think, is really important. So overlaying patient-specific
I apologize, but I think it's important. Yeah, I apologize. We lost the complete screen, Michael, so I'm not sure.
Sorry, I was trying to find the right document with that five right language in it.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we can come back, because normally I've heard of four, but you added a fifth one, which makes it a little challenging. I couldn't make up what the fifth one was.
CDS consortium. The text essentially is that.
Let's not, because.
Okay, then I will stop.
Okay.
And tell me
we'll come back and get those five R's later. And Jocelyn, I think we'll go to the transcript and pull what content we need. I'd like to move on. I don't think there are any further comments on recommendation 11. Could we please go to recommendation 12? If I'm right, there are none. Okay.
Well, there's something about identifiable deficiencies, which we discussed. I think it was you, Alex. Addressing missing info before the denial, so that's similar to what we just discussed.
Okay, so that's an old comment. Okay, so we can move on to recommendation 12 fully. This recommendation is titled Create Extension and Renewal Mechanism for Authorizations. And this essentially is getting at those complex situations where we know there's going to be ongoing treatment and we need to either logically extend or renew the prior authorization. And right now it's seen often as tremendously burdensome. And so we were looking to have this recommendation to help move that along. And Anil had a prior comment on this, that we may want to expand this to include extensions. And I think we already did that. We changed the title. So I'm thinking that is all set.
It's already done. Yeah, it's done.
Okay.
It's done.
Check. Moving on.
The work is complete.
Thank you, Michael.
That's Arian's insertions to do it. For 13.
Okay, final recommendation we'll review today is include the patient in prior authorization. So this one was really about trying to make sure they were just much more, a patient was much more involved with the process. And Neil was suggesting that it be more direct than prior auth process, be patient-centered with engagement, transparency, and power to contribute information. And I'm wondering, there looked like there were edits made that might meet your request from the Arian, did some editing
like,
after this?
This is Anil. It does look like my comment was addressed in the revised text. There's different colors and strikeouts, so I'm not sure what the final would look like, but it looks, at first glance, looks okay.
So what I'm going to say is we all get many more bites at the apple. Let's call it good. And then hopefully all we can, from what's below this, is that purple text that I was referring to that we'd like Arian and Rich to verify that you're anything that's not been struck out, you can let us know about if we need to do any further incorporating of content. But all of those are working notes below. All righty. We are now concluded our prior authorization recommendations review. Thank you for the feedback that's been provided so far. I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl to pivot conversation time.
All right. Thank you, Alex. All right. I'm sharing my screen, so I won't be able to see if anyone raises their hand. So, Alex, hopefully you can let me know.
I will certainly do so.
Let me know when you can see the screen, because I'm sharing it, and hopefully it is displaying.
It has just now fully displayed.
Okay. So just to explain why we have yet another picture, as a way to try to create some discussion for the broader intersection, I tried to put together, based on our recommendations so far and our guiding principles and initial view, not a workflow or a process flow, but just sort of an ecosystem map, if you will. I call these my place maps, so I know what are the, what are the things that we're dealing with. And what this is meant to depict is just that we have our basic, hold on, let me, my pop-ups get rid of, we have our basic stakeholders, which are providers and patients. We've got many EMR systems that are all represented on the left. Through whatever it is that we do, we have to have some sort of identity and consent management process. So we all know that regardless of what system we're using or what data that we're using, we're all talking about the same people. So although that's not a core component of what of course we've built into this privacy and security, we have not said we want to take on a special task of identity and consent management, but I did want everybody here to be aware that there's multiple groups that are looking at ways of ensuring that there are established greater security that the patient is the patient. And one of those might be through some third-party ability to manage identity management. So I didn't want to preclude that from putting a picture together. So this doesn't assume it, nor does it prevent it. It was just meant to show that identity and consent management might be supported by a third-party identity manager if that is what occurs in the ecosystem. And then we've got systems that need to interact with one another. And there may be EMR systems that are tightly coupled with labs and providers and surgical centers and others, but they might not be tightly coupled. So that's why I've shown some on the right-hand side of this picture. And those would be the ones that are not tightly integrated and maybe not sharing the same EMR system. So when we're looking at the broader intersection of clinical and administrative data,
we have already said, based on what we put together in our papers, that we want to have a system that's integrated where the clinician, the patient, the payer, and any of the other stakeholders would be able to identify what information is needed in order to take an action. And again, trying to move outside of prior authorization, it could be even making an appointment. In our recommendations, we've already addressed the fact that if we want a patient to make an appointment, the first thing we need is to know what insurance the person has or if they don't have any insurance. So we've already addressed the recommendation around having a standardized ID type card that would allow any system that's using it to be able to digitally address or accept that information by having the information in a standard format. And then, you know, potentially whatever underlying requirements are there in order for that not to have to be double keyed or typed in again by the patient in an iPad because they can't translate the information, et cetera. And often that generates a lot of problems because especially with older or anyone that needs glasses, often those numbers are so small they get mistakes when they're typing them, and that's where all of the patient identity issues really start. But anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I just want to talk about the fact that we've talked about some of these things already. What I tried to highlight here, and again, maybe everybody already knows this, but there is information that needs to go back and forth between all these stakeholders about the patient. There's also information that needs to go back and forth about, admits, discharges, and transfers. Currently in the interoperability rule, there is a provision that says the hospitals need to share this with providers, but that doesn't actually extend to payers. And it does cause some gaps with payers because I know Anthem and others try to utilize those ADTs, and we've been trying to receive those ADTs for years so that we could help get the gaps in care closed as well. You know, if a patient didn't make a follow-up appointment within 30 days of just being discharged, maybe they didn't make that rehab appointment, maybe they didn't make that physical therapy appointment, maybe they didn't fill that prescription. So there's a lot of things that we utilize that information for in order to close gaps in care that help support the provider, where we could send reminders and some of the information they may have and some they may not. Because again, if a patient uses a pharmacy, I didn't put that on here, but it should be, and the pharmacy is not tied closely into the EMR system, then they're not going to know whether the patient picked up their prescription or not, so they won't be able to get a prescription reconciliation. And some of those things are the things that we want to have when we're looking at broadening the system. So again, I tried to put a picture together that could start some conversation, but you know, some of the things that we're looking at here, what we need to challenge ourselves is what needs to be reviewed or discussed relative to that greater intersection and change and exchange of information that may not have been covered in our discussions of prior authorizations. And I know for, you know, a lot of the work that the payers do, we all are working on how to close gaps in care. And that's a significant amount of time and cost, actually, because from a payer's perspective, and let's take a national payer, and this is any national payer, in order for us to try to close those gaps in care, today we belong to, you know, multiple HIEs. We receive data from some of our providers, not all of them. All of our providers don't belong to the HIEs. They all have hundreds of EMR systems. So to try to be able to connect to all of these systems to exchange the information that is really needed to try to close these gaps in care is a significant burden on everybody. It's a cost to the provider because we're collecting it multiple different ways. I think looking at the HIE system that we have today is something we need to do because they all collect data differently. You know, we belong to probably 30 or 40 of them, and they all collect different data. They all do it with a different type of transaction. Some are X12 based, only a few actually. Most of them are data extracts. But a lot of times that data that we share doesn't actually go back to the provider at the member level. So that speaks to some of the issues I've brought up in the past regarding the need to have administrative data included in the USCDI, which we do have a recommendation for that came out of the prior authorization work. But I want to make sure we're really looking at the broader picture so that we can look at all of the types of impacts. And in the broader picture, if we, you know, strip out prior authorizations out of the thought-making process here, the patient really has also a lot of burden. They have to sign on to EMR systems for multiple EMRs. I know, you know, if I look at my daughter as an example, she has to go to four different systems for four different things. And two of them use Epic, but they're not the same Epic, so she can't get her data in one portal. So that's four different portals. And the information really needs to be shared among them all, but it isn't really. So her ability to have that data in one place is impacted, so she really can't. And then her information on her health insurance is through her payer, again, which doesn't provide a very broad view of data there either. You know, what she can see is generally, you know, 30 days plus old. She can't see a claim in the middle of the process. She can only see the claim once the claim has been paid. So I know there's a lot of ways we can go with this, but I did want to at least give us something to start with to start this conversation. I don't know if this is helpful, and I apologize if it's not, but I thought it might be. And I'd like to open it up from there to see where people would like to go with this.
So you do have a hand raised from Anil.
Hi, Anil.
Hey, Cheryl. I think this is a great start. Just a couple comments. First, I think one exercise might be to see how other groups are depicting the clinical and administrative data ecosystem so that we can refer to diagrams from different organizations and see whether our group can harmonize them. So if we start with a couple different groups, and I'm not going to pretend to be the expert on how other groups, like maybe, for example, DaVinci might be approaching this and how they're depicting it. The second one comment would be that your comment around the gaps in clinical or gaps in care insights got me thinking about, you know, what gaps in care can we not measure if we have patient information already flowing bidirectionally? And so maybe the thought would be that if you have the EHR and then you have the PHR or the patient portal off to the left, in the middle could start thinking about, are there process and outcomes metrics and definitions that need to be passed between the different data ecosystem players? Because one of the challenges we have, and you kind of alluded to it, is that we have different, quote, data models for different data collection systems, but we also have different rules. So what you might call a gap in care, one health system might have a slightly different definition for another payer. And so thinking about rules going back and forth, in addition to patient information going back and forth, I think would be an interesting way to look at that middle area that you're depicting with gaps in care insights, is that there's a lot of business rules that need to be used to figure out what you're calling a gap versus what I might not have gotten to yet as a doc or someone else might be calling a gap. So just some thoughts, but I think we do need to see how other folks are depicting this and then show how our group is harmonizing some of those thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's a really good. Go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was going to say, I go ahead. I have one person in the queue when you're ready.
I just wanted to comment. I think, Anil, that you make a really, really good point, and I do think that's a really good approach for addressing it. I know one thing that, you know, unless I'm seeing it wrong, and maybe, Jocelyn, you could weigh on this because you are the expert in the Da Vinci process, but much of Da Vinci is really focused on the use case that it's representing. So if you look at, like, PDEX or the document exchange lookup service, those all have, you know, great pictures to represent that process. But I think at the bigger level, it's really where there's a little bit of a gap. And maybe it's there, but I'm not familiar with where to go to look for it.
So Jocelyn has her hands up. If you want to stay on that theme, we can go down that theme. Because I think what you're trying to get at, Cheryl, is this idea from Anil that there's going to be models existing in the marketplace that really tackle clinical and administrative data and how we understand from those models that we could then glean the problem areas that we could then try to harmonize or overcome, if I heard Anil correctly.
Yeah.
Right. Jocelyn, do you want
to? Sure. And I'd like to maybe make a grounding comment about the fact that everyone organizationally in technology is in a very different place in the market today. And there are many vendors, providers, and payers that are working with each other to meet people where they are today using existing technologies, some of it API-based and some of it not. The work that we're doing in Da Vinci really is around identifying the business challenges themselves. And I think, Cheryl, you did a good job of capturing this. So at the highest level, if you think about the power of FHIR, it is this ability to come up with a fit-for-purpose set of resources, right, for healthcare and moving to APIs, right? But what we're doing with the IGs themselves, the implementation guides, is saying, for a particular business problem, and to your point, many of the things that you're talking about in this slide are things that are represented as implementation guides for Da Vinci, how do you do that specific work? And what we do with the implementation guide is really get to that layer down to say, using things as they're currently defined in FHIR, how would we constrain them? Where in workflow would those types of workflows actually appear? What data is available at that point in time to be exchanged between those two partners so that we can actually automate as much of that work as possible from an API perspective. And then saying where FHIR isn't specific enough or there need to be adjustments for those resources, creating profiles to say, for this specific business problem, this is how you would do it. But I think it was Arian, maybe it was Anil that made the comment. I think that one of the things that we look at is, we're not defining this for every activity, for every interaction. We're creating a set of exemplars. And part of the work that we're doing now that we're beyond sort of the first version of each implementation guide and that we've gone through balloting and we're basically sort of on the precipice of publishing a whole boatload of stuff is now turning to the community and saying, okay, we did some examples. You know, we've got exemplars out there of how to do this. Now, how does the community come together and start to do this across a larger set of exemplars? And prior auth is a really great example of this, right? We probably have done one or two exemplars. There's, you know, hundreds of different prior authorization interactions. But that core purpose of having a tool that says, do I even need to do a prior auth? And if I need to do one, what the rules are? And then if I need to do it, how do I automate it? Having that framework that we build with these implementation guides to then say this is how you do one so somebody could propose how to do another one that's slightly different is incredibly powerful when we think about trying to take all of this really intense human activity that we do today around these workflows, that there's a lot of knowledge between the button seat and the keyboard that translates this information and automate it so that human being can actually do higher purpose work. It was a little bit of a solution.
So Jocelyn, I feel like what you're also getting at, if I heard you correctly, was DaVinci is definitely giving us a way to solve an issue, but it's also doing it in ways it's trying to not get so in the weeds that the pipes that get built can't be reusable. And it's that framework I think I heard you mention that really is that model of day flow, model of data flowing that can be automated machine learning that really lets the humans go and do other things to their highest capacity to aid our patients. But it's that methodology of the framework that I think you were getting at.
Alex, I think that's a really powerful point to sort of hone in on, because I think that what we see is there's something between saying, I'm just going to do everything with fire and I'm going to write it however I want it between me and my business partners or my product in the API it interacts with, versus saying, okay, for these common interactions, how do we develop the template? And then we can expand. And so when we think about sort of the configuration or customization needs to be done, it's done at this level of really in the weeds between business partners that's going to be critically important, as opposed to everybody starting back at step number one. You're sort of doing your configuration once you get to T, U, V, W, and not at A, B, and C steps of the interactions themselves.
Yeah, I think that was
and
really
helpful. And I'm more than happy to have Anil or Arian or anyone else disagree with me. But if I get where the conversation was headed, I think this idea of saying there are frameworks that need to be created using FHIR, but I just want us to be conscious of the fact that not everybody in the industry is going to do everything via FHIR and completely FHIR right now. So the framework is what's important, and us moving towards it, what's important, not that everybody needs to be compliant sort of in year one. There's a lot of improvement we can make by moving people in the right direction.
But from a policy perspective, I really do hear two themes coming out of what you said. Meeting people where they're at with a diverse set of complex technology investments. And two, as we move forward, finding ways that our data, the core of our data, that the USCDI kind of alignment we've been discussing, really enables us to build frameworks that people can implement along the way. And so that needs to span administrative clinical ecosystems is sort of, and I think we've sort of got some of these tenets already in the guiding principles and recommendations work that Cheryl referenced before, and we're trying to really tease out where else do we want to go. And so I just want to make sure I'm hearing the right principles
yeah,
for capturing them.
I think you are, but I think the way I like to think about it when I talk about it from a consultant perspective is the fact that everyone is on this journey. And if we think about it being a stair step up in the model of maturity that we're looking for people to have in the industry, that there are so many people that are step one or not even close to step one. So how do we get them to step one? But acknowledge that there's players out there that are already up at step four and five, you know, have already done sort of this base layer, and we wouldn't want to governor them, right? So I think when we think about a policy approach, Alex, it's got to reward the folks that have invested and are ahead of the game and not stymie them, but also make sure that there's a on-ramp to the highway for the people that are just getting started and picking up their heads to deal with this challenge.
Yeah, and so I heard you call out something else, which is, you're really much, your challenge, channeling for me some of the small group discussions that we had around recommendations, and that you've nicely captured this, you know, we've got the leaders, but we've got a huge install base and we've got to figure out the bridges while also focusing on to the right destination to land. And so there's on-ramps on-ramps for all, regardless of where they're at, is something we need to think about. Of their, you know, their technology status.
Access to capital, right? Because I want to be mindful that not everybody has the ability to crack open their own EHR and put a smart app in place. You know, I want to think about that behavioral health specialist, right, that barely has technology. And I want to think about that small regional plan that we want to pass forward for them, just as we want to raise the bar for the guys that have access to capital and have the ability to throw bodies at actually building real-time APIs.
They're all really good points, and I think we need to make sure that they get captured. And it sort of helps lead into why I raised my hand And I'm going to lower it now because I'm going to go ahead and ask my question, Cheryl, which is sort of building on some of the things we've already discussed with Anil and Jocelyn, but to take us in a slightly different realm of when we're around this rules and data model comment that Anil was making, in wondering how or if we should be thinking about downstream data usage that's not just clinical or administrative, because I'm not sure how we might include some of the population health, like the public health vital records. You know, as we've been looking at COVID, we've been seeing that there's this great opportunity to tap into health information exchanges because of their ADT feeds to augment our syndromic surveillance efforts. We've talked a little bit in the past about sort of where our boundaries are on our data models, and I didn't know from a broader intersection discussion how the task force felt on whether or not that public health and vital statistics type information should be inside our scope, or if we should really, as we're looking at the broader intersection, how does public health either fit into a clinical bucket or an administrative bucket? And what does that mean to us as we move forward? So a couple of hands raised.
Okay. Let's go with the people who are raising their hands. And I think that was a great question to pose to the team. I can't see who they are, so you go ahead and call the list.
Sure. We'll start with Anil and then move to Jocelyn.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's a great point. And if we're going to go through the effort of harmonizing or aligning clinical and administrative data, given that there are public health needs, but also not forgetting the broader clinical research and the research operations that typically fits into this paradigm, which is somewhat related to public health, but not typically, I think we should be thinking about all those additional use cases that are benefited by the work we do around aligning clinical and administrative data. Thinking through that the stakeholders and the actors of the future are going to have a much bigger vested interest in public health than we've seen thus far. So it's a great question, and I think we should use the opportunity to not forget that the efficiencies created here will benefit other use cases that benefit people in general. But
that's a really good point. Talk about, I hadn't thought about the reducing burden, but the data flowing for vital records is what I kind of also heard in when you were talking, but that whole research for evidence-based medicine and that churn, because this is all connected. So those are good points. And the next person in the queue is Jocelyn.
So Alex, the only point I was going to make is, and I agree with what Anil just said, is I think that thinking about the needs around population level data is something that we are seeing the plans that are more advanced and the provider systems that are more advanced really ready for in the DaVinci world. So this ability to be able to port sort of statistics at sort of a system level or creating norms, I think is incredibly important. And I would just separate out sort of what we're doing to support public health from population level information as two very distinct camps. That's all.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so glad you said it, because I'm like, but population health is different than what I was thinking. And so you're underscoring my point, which is we shouldn't conflate those. They're very different. And I agree with you, Jocelyn. So thank you for
I have friends at Providence St. Joseph and the like advanced gameplay they have going on around population level data compared to some of the other provider orgs out there. So
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I'm really thinking about that data flow needs, that provider burden that will, of feeding lab cancer registries, the syndromic surveillance needs, all of those new data elements that we're going to become much more dependent upon now that we've garnered a deeper appreciation for public health emergencies.
Yeah, I mean,
Cheryl,
I
there
know
are no other hands up.
Okay, I know to speak to that question too. the CDC asked multiple payers for data on COVID, and one of the things that they called out was that some payers were providing data with CPT codes and others with DRGs. So they had to reconcile all of that. And we often have a lot of those disparities come up with the reporting of APCD data, where it's obvious that not all systems capture data the same way. And so what I would caution us about is that what happens with APCD, which I would not like to see happen here, is we're often being told to change the data so it can be consistent from the state's perspective. But my concern is every time data is morphed, it becomes further apart from the source. And so it's left to some interpretation on how that data is morphed. And so from a research perspective, Anthem would never change the data from its source that we were reporting on. But often data that is in these APCDs is changed drastically from its source. So just want to get something like that out on the table, that, you know, whatever it is that we do recommend, it would be consistency would be important in terms of the way the data is either captured or exchanged, rather than having have some layer added after the fact to then change the data to what someone needs so that they can report on it more easily. And again, that to me, that just then definitely impacts the quality of the data.
So a very interesting thought process here, Cheryl, because it really starts to speak to maybe the sort of the provenance of the data and being able to port that through when the data makes the hops, and also the ensuring that you're complying with the consent aspects of how that data is to be used. So, you know,
make it clear for this group, in the APCD world, we have multiple things that the payers have to live with, and one is a prompt payment rule. So in multiple states where you have a prompt payment rule, payments must be made within so many days if the data is, once it's complete. And what they have in terms of what's complete is a very small list. So that's what must be there in the next 12 transaction in order for us to make a payment. But when it gets to the APCD, they want what we call literally hundreds of aspirational fields that may not be present on the claim, but they're expecting us to produce data in there because that's what they want to have to review it. So, you know, with whatever it is we're doing, I just hope that we're going to focus on what's real in the way that it actually works rather than what's aspirational. Because defining what should be and defining what is not always the same. That's my only thing I want to throw out there. And I love the idea of having vital records connected. I do know that in some states, and I don't know why, but there are some limitations from state rules related to connecting the vital records, because they have those with the APCDs today. And they're unable to connect, you know, birth records and death records for some reason, and usually it's something in the law that prevents it. And multiple states are trying to work through those, but that is just for this group to be aware.
But that's a secondary usage of those, as opposed to what I wasn't thinking in that concept when I made the suggestion. I was thinking in the concept of providers need to submit data to various public health registries, including but not limited to birth and death registries or immunization registries, for instance, and that information flow out of electronic health record could be an area of burden, and that we might be able to think about the information flow and the services that enable that, because most public health registries do use HL72.x versions. And so if we could think about that as part of our data model, we might be able to benefit not only the timeliness, but also reduce the burden. And so what I hear you also saying is another problem that I'm very well aware of, which is as we start to want to aggregate data sources to inform policymaking related to all payer claims databases or APCDs, sometimes they bring together sources of data. And when it comes to public health, you can't always tap into those for laws, and that's very common. But I think there's also this downstream data fidelity that I was hearing you mention. And so I think we might have tackled that if we actually accomplished the robust mapping recommendation that we already have. So I think that that's sort of an important aspect. But I also think that you elevated another aspect for me, which is in the broader convergence conversation of clinical and administrative data, data does get used downstream for all kinds of other things that we've been talking about, population health, public health, claims processing, et cetera. But is there an implication into our conversations that we either need to leave on the table or throw out, is this aspect of how the data that we use does inform policymaking? And is there some, because we've called out evidence-based medicine and other ancillary services, but what about the policy downstream that gets informed from such things as we've crunched an APCD and we think we know that there are way too many CABG surgeries being done, for instance? Is that something we need to think about?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that most of the APCDs today do look at the waste calculator that, you know, and I think, quote, the Milliman one is often talked about, but that list of waste calculator procedures, and so they measure against that to determine, you know, what type of waste is most occurring. And again, there's a lot of dispute in these conversations because I participate in most of them across the country on whether or not that really is waste. I think there are a lot of physicians that feel like some of these things that have made it to the list they wouldn't necessarily agree to. But what it does at a minimum say is that there is some perhaps education that needs to occur, but most health systems are not using the list for that purpose. They're basically using it as a, you know, sort of to inform the state, oh, this is what showed up for these lists of providers and that appears to be wasteful. And so it's always kind of a negative bent to it. And again, I'm not trying to evaluate whether that's worthwhile or not, but it causes a lot of concern from providers and people.
Yeah.
Thank you. We have a Neil's hand up.
Yeah, I just want to underscore a couple things that I heard, and I think it's all really, really important that we have people start to think about those use cases, but I don't want us to also minimize the challenge when it comes to having additional use cases. So the code sets, the documentation, the diagnoses, procedures, laboratory tests, and the way we describe them all, I think might serve really well from a clinical and administrative point of view, you know, except for the exceptions that Cheryl just spoke about in terms of appropriateness of CABG or whatever. But when you start to get into additional use cases, thinking through vital statistics, we want to make sure we emphasize that we'll need to have additional ways of harmonizing all the ways that we describe things, because taking something as a simple example, the death certificate, you can't simply use data coming out of the electronic medical record or any billing system to figure out what a death certificate might need to look like. And that's a simple example. There's much more complicated things when we get to public health and clinical research. So I think having a comment that although this is our goal and that we want people to be thinking about how this harmonization will help additional use cases, we understand there's a significant amount of complexity with bringing those universes into the same world that we're living in with the clinical administrative data. I mean, I might have 25 different ways of describing a diabetic in the clinical setting, but if I was doing clinical research or I was doing public health, I might have significantly more ways of describing that. And I just want to make sure we don't minimize the complexity involved when we bring different use cases in, although we should create the environment for those to be brought in with the right code sets and terminologies and an understanding that some more investment will need to be made.
I really like what I'm hearing you say, Neil, because I agree with you. You know, like, you know, and the death record example was perfect because basically that's happening. The death record generation happens way outside of the EHR. And so I was trying to help us start to create some boundaries. And I think what you started to do is help us to say we can create some kind of content for our report around this, creating the environment and supporting those downstream needs, but we really want to stay, keep ourselves from going into the weeds of the complexities of all the use cases. And so I think that there is maybe something that Rich might have said in his chat box, and I'm going to read it, is that his feeling is that we do need to incorporate public health research vital records into the converged ecosystem. I don't know that we're at a point where we can propose solutions, but we do need to ensure that while working on the convergence, we leave both the architecture and the expectation for further work in those areas. And I think that's sort of getting at what you're saying, which is create the framework, put a line in the sand to respect it, but don't, let's not get ourselves wrapped around the axle on that one for right now.
Yeah, I think it does say it. I just minimized my window. It was expanded so I could see the screen, and I see Rich's comment now. I think he said it much more succinctly, but yep, that's what I'm getting at.
Cool, yeah.
I agree with that as well. Do we have other questions, Alex?
No, there are no hands raised at this time.
So some of the themes we just talked about then is to further expand the need for code sets and maybe it is worthwhile to identify a sample. And maybe this is too detailed, but this is what I'm going to throw out here, sort of a sample group of data from the administrative side that should be looked at from a USCBI perspective for standardization as a starting point. That might be one aspect that would be helpful. The other would be how to translate, these things like ADTs and gaps in care into business rules, which I believe Anil also mentioned, from the perspective that the intersection and the broadening of clinical administrative needs to support the broader business rules for not only, again, provider to payer, but also the integration of the patient and all those ancillary other systems that may not be tightly coupled with the EMR system, so that data can flow more easily and more consistently across. Because that's another thing, like one of the examples, and again, I don't know any other way to do this than to point to an example, but when we were working with the CDC, they mentioned that some labs were reporting data with LOINC and others were reporting data with a different standard. So before they could use anything, they had to normalize the data. I don't know, is there a piece of our process where we want to recommend certain code sets or standards be used for certain purposes to make that research base more consistent and more easily attained?
This is Alex, and I'm struggling a little bit with that question. I see Anil put his hand up too, so I yield to you, Anil.
Yeah, no, I think we might be on the same thought. I think we want to stay away from telling the researchers how they want their information represented. My general feel, and I've done clinical research, I've seen patients, and now I work for a company that does a little bit of this curation business, is that it depends on the use case, and we don't want to add burden to the system. So I think the thing to do, at least for our committee at this point, or our task force, is to acknowledge that there's some work that needs to be done and create an environment by which that work can be done and then brought back into an environment where we're at least harmonizing clinical administrative data. We are not going to be able to ask doctors like me and like my colleagues to start collecting the significantly more granular data needed for some public health projects or for some clinical research. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is say, for the clinical and administrative piece, how can we start to bring those different things together so we create a minimum data set that is not asking doctors to be clinical researchers or to really understand the way that clinical research is done, but we're simply saying is, here's a minimum data set. Now, you guys in public health, you guys in clinical research, here's a more refined way of looking at an aligned clinical and administrative picture. See what you can do, but you might need to build upon this. You might need to extend this and expand this, but I don't think we should be asking all the rank and file care teams to start collecting data for a purpose that they might see deviate from the patient care side, because it's going to add burden, and without knowing all the use cases, it's going to add burden without any good reason.
Yeah, I was sort of going there, but not quite, Anil. Where I was going to go with this was, we have in our existing recommendations and guiding principles for prior auth talked about harmonizing code sets, code and value sets, and that I was thinking that there would likely be some higher level policy statement about, you know, making sure that that we wanted possibly to make sure that there were the efforts that we were touting for maybe NLM to work on with ONC and others could take and make sure that those were the downstream environments were factored in, but I believe that there is there are plenty of ability to pull content for public health registry messaging from, you know, within an from an EHR pretty systematically when you look at the use of the HL7 data existing within many EHRs. So I was not trying to create something specific. I was thinking about more about how do we get the automation that enables that data to more effectively flow without having anybody's fingertips on it. They actually, we could get those submissions to happen, and we want to make sure that we're not losing sight of that as we look at this broader intersection of clinical administrative data. And when I think about the clinical code set values and the administrative code set values, I think it's all tied back to maybe this comment that Cheryl made about this USCDI, and just making sure all this stuff is woven together. And I think I would propose that we would focus at that concept level for what we would want to move forward, because I think you'd want to get a different set of people to possibly look at that and then augment whatever mappings might get pursued.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But just I'll give you one quick example of where I don't think we should go. So let's assume that there's a public health project looking at asthma, and we'll just pick Cleveland, where I live, or the Cleveland area. And if you were to start pulling out of the record whether the individual patient has carpeting in their home, or that they live in an apartment versus a house, or things that might haphazardly be collected in the EHR, but are incredibly important for asthma and public health, we could create an environment where somehow there's a USCDI data model that talks about the person's home. And while they might be important for some segment of patients, we don't want to give anyone the impression that we're all of a sudden going to start collecting that information on each and every patient. And but I agree with your broader statement. If it's a data exhaust or a byproduct of clinical care, we want to make sure it's available at the highest fidelity to anyone who wants to use it downstream. If it's not a byproduct of clinical care, then we should go through a community-based process of understanding what it takes to collect that data, because it's in the public good. That's a very different, you know, perspective.
Oh, yeah, and I'm with you on that line. I will take Cheryl. I'm going to just note that we're about 4 minutes away from meeting to take public comment. 3 minutes away, we have no hands raised, so maybe we can finish this up and then hand it over to Lauren. I'm not sure if you're able to see all the panels on your Adobe.
I can't see anything. I'm sharing the picture.
Okay. Cool beans. So you got 2.5
yeah.
minutes and counting. So I do agree with promoting the auto-generated as a clinical, you know, byproduct. And then you made a comment about, you know, if otherwise, you know, engage community, figure it out. Because we don't. I'm totally in agreement with you, Anil, and I'm not seeing any other hands raised on that point. So nor am I seeing a lot of comments come in, although Jocelyn did. Rich agreed with you, and Jocelyn also went on to further note that there are other fire accelerator programs handling a lot of other service functions, data need functions for those downstream services like social determinants of health and cancer, et cetera. So I think we've got the framing of maybe an additional comment, Cheryl, or concepts,
yeah.
or I'm not sure where it will go yet, but...
So let's talk a little bit about then where do we go from here with this? Because for our next meeting, you know, of course, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about what happened in the high-tech meeting because we have
mm-hmm.
that tomorrow. But we really want to start with this broader intersection and sort of go to the next place. I heard some themes today that I think we can start with. And sort of instead of focus on a picture, really focus on the themes, which were, you know, basically looking at the data from an ecosystem perspective, and then focusing on code sets and harmonization and what we might be able to pull it up to the level of how to harmonize at the ecosystem level, more than just, you know, specific use cases. Because that's really the dichotomy. We're doing a lot of work in a lot of places right now at a detailed level, and we're trying to look at this from a macro level. And so what are the most important things that we need to focus on? I think the harmonization of the code sets, ensuring that we have this level of administrative data captured somewhere with the most important administrative information to start at a minimum set per what, you know, Anil and I were talking about. I think the other thing is ensuring that these stakeholders that are not what I'm going to call tightly coupled to these EMR systems have the ability to, through either some standard or certification process, share the data they have to share on the patient at the member level, you know, with each of the EMR systems. So if that means we need to further expand certain use cases within DaVinci or whatever to make some of those things help some of those things get worked on, then identifying what some of those might be. And then I think the last thing was that we talked about was the interplay of downstream with public health and vital records and how that all comes into play and where it comes into play, how we would want to see that space addressed.
We are now at 4:20. No hands
okay.
are raised.
I'll break there so we can go to public comment.
Great. Thanks, Cheryl. Operator, can we open a line at this time?
Yes. If you have a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we poll for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Thank you, Alex. We'll keep you notified if we do get comments.
Thanks very much. All right, so Cheryl, I think you are in a role of trying to do a recap of themes with the idea that I think I heard you have at least 3, if not 4 themes as to areas we might be able to build out as our starting point for next call, but I'm not sure if you finished your list.
Thank you. I don't know if I finished my list either. I tried to take notes with my wounded wing while I was doing this because I couldn't use my computer. But I think the other thing we talked about was that Neil brought up, and I think it was important, is that to do a scan of what's currently available in terms of models. I did look, just so you know, at a number of the DaVinci use cases before we put together our picture, and I have looked at a number of other stakeholders, but I don't know that I looked at everything that is out there. And so if there is a better picture we can use to depict this broader intersection, then I think that that's maybe something I'm going to ask the entire team to take a look at. And if you are aware of a diagram that you think would be helpful for us to put into our process, let Alex and I know, and then we can make sure that we bring it back to this group.
I commiserate with your challenges in finding that picture. I've been sketching one out myself. So I really hope people will give us their examples.
Yeah, and I mean, I also really resonated with the example, Anil, that you brought up about asthma. It reminded me of a project that I did with UConn a long time ago, actually, where they were really looking at environmental factors to see what impact they had on asthma. And essentially, we had to build a system to support looking at that for this physician that wanted to do this project. And it was, you know, kind of a lengthy process. So I do understand the nature of how that collection of information, A, can be quite burdensome and is quite time-consuming, but also the way in the form in which you collect that information makes a difference. For instance, it may be something that typically a physician would ask if someone has an issue about a trigger, you know, what, you know, tell me a little bit about where you live, and who knows what they might capture as far as that goes, but it might be enough information for them to help guide you with the treatment or a medication, but it wouldn't be something the EMR potentially could really capture, you know, in any standard or structured way for them to do anything about. So, you know, it's really key. That was a great example, actually. But I think that then, you know, speaks to what we're talking about here. I mean, I keep thinking about, you know, if we can't ignore the COVID thing that we're all dealing with, certainly there's going to be information that's going to be needed by both administrative and clinical going forward. They, you know, looking at contact information and where people have traveled to and, you know, who you've been exposed to. And certainly systems can't capture all of those things. But in this situation, in today's pandemic, those are important aspects. So, you know, maybe understanding what some of the key triggers are for a particular condition or situation need to be considered as each one of those examples would be worked on in a more detailed way, but that's probably not something that we're going to tackle.
So I'm getting a little bit lost, Cheryl, and whether you're looking for wanting to go into use cases or you're looking for a general picture that puts the components of payers, providers, care, and coverage with the HIPAA and the cures world, I'm trying to figure out whether you want to look at all the use cases or you don't. You just want a bigger picture. I'm not sure what the ask is.
I don't think we want to look at use cases. I think there's too many with too many variables. I think that we need to focus on what the themes are that we would want included in the broader intersection, and we should focus on those.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. I believe we're at the next step slide, which I think maybe you're covering, but you may not be able to see that if you still have your screen up. So let me know if you'd like me to go ahead.
I can see it. So thank you, everybody, for your input today, both on the broader intersection and the report. Tomorrow we are going to be presenting the high tech. That's Alex and myself. And I'm sure we're going to get input and feedback from them. Right now, they're only going to see our recommendations in a PowerPoint. We're not sharing the paper yet. We're hoping to be able to share the paper before the October meeting. And so we need to do a bit of cleanup with that paper. So please go in and look at the Google Doc. If you have questions or comments, now is the time to include them. I think what we'll do next week, and Alex and I will talk about this some more in a few minutes, is continue our conversation on the broader intersection after we've provided the feedback from High Tech and we reviewed any task force comments on the Google paper. There are some additional comments that have been made on the ideal state and the guiding principles after we had our initial discussion on them. So if we have time, we could go back and look at those. I think, though, we should try to focus our time on the broader intersection conversation so we can capture more detail around those themes before we actually go back and review the comments in the paper, because we're going to have to weave those in anyway, and we can cover those additional comments when we're weaving in those broader intersection comments. And, Alex, what are you in agreement with that approach?
Yeah, I think we'll definitely hone our thinking as you and I will have a call scheduled right after this. I think we need to reconcile our notes because I think I might have taken a few different things that jumped out for me. So we'll certainly evolve the themes and give us a launch off point for next week after we debrief the team.
I think that's great. So remember offline, please continue commenting on the Google document and also, if you're able to join the High Tech meeting tomorrow, let us know your feedback from that as well. Any final comments, Alex?
No, you wrapped up nicely. Thank you.
All right. Any public comments waiting?
There are no comments.
No comments.
All right, then I'll turn it over to you, Lauren. You can close her up.
I think that's it for today. We'll just meet again next week with feedback from the committee. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn for
thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.